Ghoulish greetings, everyone. Those tunes you're hearing is courtesy of the amazing Bobby Mackey. You're also going to be hearing music by Stick the Landing as well.
Was it because you missed me that made you come last night? Did I see us back together when I read between the lines?
I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow, and thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift, whenever you listen, and wherever you are listening from isolated island to the scorching hot desert, from tiny village to the hustle and bustle of the big city, and everything in between. It is greatly appreciated. Speaking of places, where will this week's special city shoutouts take us to? Sant Feliu de Llobregat, Spain. Sorry for butchering that. Great Yarmouth, England. Mississauga, Canada. Hendersonville, North Carolina. Athens, Ohio. And Newark, New Jersey. The young woman is at a stop sign in her car. An elderly man begins to cross the walk. He looks slowly at her, smiles, does a small little wave her way.
Thanks for stopping, kind lady, and good day to you.
He continues walking slowly, when suddenly a young boy, with a hat on backwards and raggedy black and red shorts and a surf's-up shirt on a skateboard, cuts in front of the man. This causes the man to stumble, and he falls. And it shakes the woman to her core. You see, it could have been a lot worse. It could have been a car. It could have been something else, right? But the night before, she had this dream where she was at this particular stop sign situated on Main, and she sees this specific man walk by, and the kid, well, he's wearing those exact clothes, but how could this be? It's like she sees into the future. But again, how can this be? Premonitions. It's not psychics looking into some crystal ball and making money on telling someone's future. People don't ask for this. It just happens. They don't go looking for this. And sometimes it just kind of falls into their laps. And they don't know what it is until it's already happened later on in life. Premonitions. Sometimes it's a warning of an upcoming death. Or my fake man falling due to a kid on a skateboard. Premonitions. So today I'm going to talk about a small handful of cases where someone saw something and guess what? It happened later on. To the detail. And some cases may not straight up be premonitions, but I just thought they were very interesting. So the first one I'm going to talk about has to do with the band Mamonas Assassinas. They were a pop rock band from Brazil. And actually, you know, these guys were originally going to be on one of my Rocker Death episodes, but then I waited out and I felt it would be more appropriate to have them in the premonitions episode. So here we go. Mamonas Assassinas, meaning killer big breasts. They were adored throughout Brazil. The band consisted of Alexander Alves, Bento Hinoto, Samuel Reoli, Sergio Reoli, and Julio Rasek. Time is running out for Mamonas Assassinas. March 1st, 1996. Julio Rasek is at the barbershop, and he's talking with his friend slash hairdresser. And he's telling this person about a horrible nightmare that he had, and he could not get it out of his mind. It wasn't some foggy dream. It was real. So detailed. So vivid. To me, this reminds me kind of like a visitation dream. You know? when grandma comes back from the grave and visits you, and it's just, you could remember every single word, every single movement. So he had no idea what this nightmare meant, but it chilled him to the absolute bone. This discussion was actually caught on video, whether it was from a fan, a friend, or somebody getting their haircut, I'm unsure. But Julio was uneasy that entire day, and he had a good reason to be. The very next day, tragedy strikes in the friendly skies and leaves no survivors. Time is indeed running out for Julio and his band, the Killer Big Breasts. Tick tock, tick tock. It's now March 2nd, 1996. The Mamonas Assassinas just completed a concert in Brasilia and jump in a Learjet and they head towards Sao Paulo. They are almost at their destination, mind you, when the pilot begins communicating that the weather is acting up. He then goes to the left and heads in the complete wrong direction. They should have went right. They were so close to their final destination. It's a quarter past 11 p.m. when the Learjet carrying the band strikes some trees, crashes right into a densely wooded area in the Cantataria Mountains. So incredibly close. So close. Sao Paulo is right there. The following morning, authorities and first responders successfully get to the crash site, and what lie before them was utterly tragic and just completely heartbreaking. Every single person was dead. One of the men, Alexander Alves, better known as Dino, he was decapitated. In some reports, I see that it was 7 band members that were killed, so I'm really unsure exactly of the number, but we do know that at least 5 men from this band, Mamonas Assassinas, died that fateful day. And you know, 2 of them had the same last name, so somebody had to bury 2 of their own. So that's like, oh my god. Over 100,000 family, friends and fans all morning came together for this funeral, honoring the men that were taken way too soon. Many poo-poo that this was a premonition, and maybe it wasn't, for we don't really know what this nightmare was that Julio had, but what is known is that whatever it was, it frightened him, and he was scared that entire final full day of his life, almost like he knew that his time would soon expire. Tick tock, tick tock, tick. Maureen Flavin Sweeney was a lighthouse keeper's wife, and life was good here in Ireland. She was a woman of many talents, one of those things being a postmistress and a weather observer. She was amazing. Her phenomenal status as a weather observer gained the trust of Eisenhower, and it would ensure the success of D-Day invasion of Normandy during World War II. Maureen's job and duties were to record and transmit weather data, and in the past they would do a weather report every 6 hours. But with World War II, they were on top of it, and they were ordered to do this hourly. And in Maureen's own words, she would say this, quote, "You would only have one finished when it was time to do another," unquote. Her ever so accurate prediction was that a dangerous storm would be touching down and batter Europe. Several other people were there that day working, and she is the only one who saw this. It's almost like she felt this in her core. The day is June 3rd, and it just happens to be this young woman's 21st birthday. It may be the day she was born, but there's work to do. People, they're depending on her. It could be the difference between life and death. There is no time for birthday cake. Not today. Not on June 3rd, 1944. Maureen happens to be working the graveyard shift this particular day, so she could have cake later. Working from midnight until 4 a.m. And at one point, she checks her barometer. She sees a drop in the pressure. That seems to be a warning of rain or something even worse, possibly. It's hard to tell. After some communication, Dwight Eisenhower is convinced this is the right thing to do because this young woman has never led him astray. She has always been dead accurate. And he delays the invasion by one day. Remember, this was a brutal storm that still did some pretty major damage, and it brought extremely high winds, rough as hell water in the sea, and a thick fog that plagued the area. Visibility was a bitch. Yes, June 5th was a horrible day, and things would have certainly gone so much differently if they had not changed it by a day. Now, from what history tells us and what I learned from my grandfather's own private journal entries from World War II, D-Day was no bright, sunny, welcoming day. No, it was no walk in the park. A skip to my loo. The storm was still doing its thing, but the day earlier was so much worse. Incredibly worse. Maureen was the first person to report anything about this storm. She indeed saved many lives. D-Day veteran Joe Catini is one of the countless veterans who is so grateful for this woman and what she did. Quote, "We owe a lot to Maureen of the west of Ireland, us who invaded France on D-Day, because if it hadn't been for her reading of the weather, we would have perished in the storms." Unquote. Decades later, Maureen would say this in an interview with a journalist, quote, "There they were with thousands of aircraft, and they couldn't tolerate low cloud. We're delighted we put them on the right road. We eventually had the final say." Unquote. Believe it or not, Maureen would not even know how important her weather report was until 12 years later, in 1956. Don't know how that happened, but it did. Now, she died in mid-December 2023. Yes, not even a year ago. She did make it to 100. Bless her heart for saving so many people so long ago. And for making it to triple digits, baby. That's pretty awesome. In 1898, Morgan Robertson, he wrote a novel titled Futility, and it's about an unsinkable, gigantic mega ship, and he called it the Titan. And I think it's pretty easy to guess what I will be talking about in this particular case. Morgan talks about brass bands and orchestras and just how unsinkable the Titan is. Quote, "With 9 compartments flooded, the ship would still float, and has no known accident of the sea. Could possibly fill this many. The steamship Titan was considered practically unsinkable." Unquote. He goes on to describe the Titan. Quote, "She was 800 feet long, of 70,000 tons displacement, 75,000 horsepower." Unquote. You know, the dimensions, they're not exact. Let's compare. Titanic, 882 feet versus Titan's 800 feet. The Titan's displacement was 70,000 tons, where the Titanic's was 52,310 tons. Titanic horsepower, 46,000. Titan horsepower, 75,000. Both were mega ships. Both were deemed unsinkable. And guess what? Both sank. In the novel Futility, Morgan Robertson talks about how they had the necessary limit of lifeboats to satisfy the law. But it was kind of like an inconvenience, like, oh, we're going to do this because we have to. We don't want to do this, so we're going to put as few as possible, right? It's unsinkable. We don't need these. This is just for decoration, baby. You know, if trouble actually came and the ship was full, many people would find themselves in deep water, literally. The result, well, it would be indeed catastrophic. But because it was deemed unsinkable, they felt it was not mandatory to have the accurate amount of lifeboats to help every single person at full capacity, just like the fateful RMS Titanic. Morgan writes this, quote, "It was unsinkable, indestructible. She carried as few boats as would satisfy the laws," unquote. It is now April 15th of 1912, several years, 14 to be exact, after Morgan's novel, Futility, was published. And what a dreadful day it is for the history books as the Titanic strikes an iceberg, and due to there not being enough lifeboats, many of the Titanic's occupants, over 1,500 people, well, they're killed, and the unsinkable sinks. Now, I didn't get to read the entire book, but I did get to read a sample of it online, and there are several similarities when it comes to the novel and true events that happened that April day back in 1912. The name alone, Titan and Titanic, is haunting. In both book and real life, there were not enough lifeboats. In both cases, the megaship hits an iceberg while traveling in the North Atlantic. Both took place in April, and guess what? Both the Titan and Titanic, which were both deemed unsinkable massive vessels, they sank. Also, something haunting that Morgan adds to his novel, which happened in real life as well, is due to the steering of the ship and the way it hit the iceberg, that is most certainly why it sank. And this is what happened in real life as well. When First Officer William Murdoch demands the ship to be steered around this gigantic iceberg. Now, mind you, when Morgan Robertson wrote this novel, it's not like he was like, oh, the Titanic, that's a beautiful vessel. Let me describe it as it is and all this stuff. No, the Titanic had not even existed yet. It was constructed between the years 1909, finally being completed in 1911. He had written Futility 14 years earlier. There were so many similarities, though, between book and real life that many people began to believe that Morgan Robertson was a clairvoyant, a psychic, something or someone that just cannot be explained, in which he fully denied these claims. One interesting fact when it comes to Titanic is that the owner, J.P. Morgan, did not know he was the owner, was supposed to travel on the maiden voyage, but at the very last second, he canceled. The guilt he must have felt. And also, I think it is kind of interesting that Morgan Robertson wrote this book about Titan, and J.P. Morgan would be the owner of the Titanic. Morgan and Morgan. I don't know.
Something ahead, sir. Can't make it out.
Sharon Tate. You hear that name and many people automatically go to Charles Manson and his disgusting cult. Sharon Tate, a woman who was 8.5 months pregnant, whose plans that night were nothing more than to have a great time with her dear close friends. But none of these people knew just exactly how brutal of an ending the night would be for them. Tate shared with Fate magazine, a magazine dedicated to supernatural and paranormal happenings and what have you, that she had a horrifying vision one fateful night while at her ex-boyfriend slash dear friend's home. She woke up in the middle of the night, and this is her own words, quote, "I saw something or someone tied to the staircase. Whoever it was, I couldn't tell if it was a man or a woman, but I knew somehow that it was either Jay Sebring or me. He or she was cut open at the throat," unquote. Well, that's traumatizing. It's eerie that just the following year, both of these individuals, along with several others, would be brutally murdered. It's also eerie that here Sharon is. She was at Jay's house. She has this horrible experience, and in her heart, she knows that this person is either her or Jay. And, you know, both are going to be wiped out by the Manson cult. This poor woman, this mother-to-be, was just 2 weeks shy of giving birth to her sweet baby. The baby who she would never get to hear its giggle. Never hear the laughter. Never get to play with it. Never look into its precious sweet face and watch it grow up. Yeah, this woman, she was not only robbed of her life, but she was robbed of motherhood. Something she was looking very, very forward to. Her future looked so bright. And it was interesting to me because at one point, she is asked in an interview about her comfort levels when it came to filming in the nude, and this was her response, quote, "I honestly don't understand the big fuss made over nudity and sex in films. It's silly. On TV, the children can watch people murdering each other, which is a very unnatural thing, but they can't watch two people in a very natural process of making love. Now really, that doesn't make any sense, does it?" Unquote. People murdering each other. That's exactly what happened to Sharon Tate and her dear friends. And yes, I agree. It seems like it's a very unnatural thing, but sadly, it's an extremely common occurrence. Murder. One person who was invited but declined to go to this friendly get-together amongst friends was none other than Steve McQueen. When he went to the funerals of his friends, he indeed made sure to bring a gun, just in case. One of Manson's lame, pathetic followers was a young woman named Susan Atkins, and at her murder trial, she shared that Tex told her to stab Sharon, and that's exactly what she did. Someone told you to jump off a bridge, would ya? But she had no clue on how many times she actually stabbed the pregnant woman. New York Times shares more details. Quote, Atkins testified that she couldn't recall how many times she stabbed Tate, but the coroner in the case, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, counted. He declared on the stand that Tate was stabbed 16 times, 8 times in her back, twice in her upper right arm, and once in her right thigh. She was also slashed twice on her left forearm, leaving what he called superficial wounds, unquote. In a bragging-like way, Atkins said this when it came to Sharon Tate and mother-to-be and actress. Quote, "Please don't kill me." And I told her to shut up, and I threw her down on the couch. She said, "Please, let me have my baby." Then Tex came in and said, "Kill her." And I killed her. I just stabbed her, and she fell, and I stabbed her again. I don't know how many times. I don't know why I stabbed her. Unquote. Because you're a sick, demented freak? That's why, Susan Atkins. In 1992, Nine Inch Nails frontman Trent Reznor, he rents the home for $11,000 a month. Remember, this is back in 1992. I know California's always been expensive, but my lord. Today, that's equivalent to $24,532, give or take. He even records the beloved album Downward Spiral there, and he ended up meeting Sharon Tate's sister, and he quickly changed his tune, his opinion, when it came to living there. Quote, "I guess it never really struck me before, but it did then. She lost her sister from a senseless, ignorant situation, and I don't want to support that. She was talking to me, and I realized for the very first time, what if that was my sister? And I thought, fuck Charlie Manson. I don't want to be looked at as a guy who supports serial killer bullshit," unquote. The final case that I want to talk about today has to do with Samuel Clemens, better known to many as Mark Twain. So while I'm talking about him, you may hear me refer to him as Sam, Samuel, Mark Twain, Clemens. It's all about him, obviously. So he actually has two premonitions, one that has to do with a beloved family member and the other about himself. And I'm going to talk about the first one, and that has to do when he had a premonition about his very own younger brother. You see, he had this horrible dream about Henry, and the dream was so accurate to what would take place in real life that it haunted Samuel Clemens for the rest of his life. These two brothers, they were close, and they were only really a few years apart. And they had planned a trip together, and the night before they were to sail off on a riverboat called the Pennsylvania, Clemens has a dream. Scratch that. It was a nightmare. And in this nightmare, Henry is dead. He's lying there, he's stiff as a board, and he's in a metal casket. He is wearing a suit that does not belong to him. Perhaps it was one of his brother's suits, is what Mark Twain thought. And on the center of his chest is a large bouquet of these just ever so gorgeous white flowers, with one red lone rose smack dab right in the middle. Well, let's fast forward, shall we, to the sad, tragic events that take place just the following day. The brothers, they're on the Pennsylvania. The pilot, he is a man named William Brown. Brown was a very violent individual. It doesn't take a lot for this ill-tempered man to lose control. He's confrontational. In other words, let's face it, he's an asshole. Yeah. At some point, Twain and Brown, they get into a fight, and the captain intervenes, and he believed that Mark Twain was in the right, and it was decided that once they arrive in New Orleans at the port, that they would find somebody else to be the pilot for this particular vessel, that being the Pennsylvania. Sadly, though, they had no luck in finding anybody, and since it was obvious that these two men could not be near each other without raising a fist, they obviously needed a pilot, even though he was a violent jackass. He was an experienced violent jackass pilot. So Clemens was forced to go onto another ship. And I really don't understand why his brother was not able to just go with him. Like, was there not room on the ship? Like, why would they separate? You know what I mean? So brothers, knowing that they are going to be separated soon, discuss emergency situations, which included what to do if there was a boiler explosion, which sadly was a common occurrence. Well, tragedy strikes on the Pennsylvania riverboat and an explosion takes place just as the brothers feared may happen. Henry, he is severely burned, but he did not die immediately. No, Henry Clemens' death was a prolonged and excruciatingly painful one. He suffered for several days before finally dying from his injuries in Memphis. While Henry's body was dealt with some severe major burns, his face was actually untouched. Clemens, he walks into what they call the dead room at the Memphis Exchange, only to see his dear brother in a metal casket and a suit that was not his own. So far, this is mirroring his nightmare. But there's one huge difference. There are no flowers in sight. He sits there and he's mourning the death of his brother, sitting there staring at the body. When soon a woman enters the room and she has a bouquet of flowers in her hands, she places that bouquet on Henry Clemens' chest. Any guesses on what the flowers were? Yeah, you guys, a gorgeous white flower bouquet with a lone red rose smack dab right in the middle, just exactly like he saw in his dream, nightmare, his vision. Henry's death haunted Sam for the rest of his life. He felt that perhaps he could have prevented Henry's death. The fact that he saw this before it happened never sat well with him. He felt like he could have saved his brother. I mean, it's sad because you have this guilt, but yeah, it was a horrible thing that happened. But it's like, of course you don't think this is going to happen in real life, you know? Now, the other premonition happened in 1909 when Mark Twain said this regarding his own death. Quote, "I came in with Halley's Comet in 1835. It is coming again next year and I expect to go out with it. It will be the greatest disappointment of my life if I don't go out with Halley's Comet. The Almighty said, no doubt. Now there are these two unaccountable freaks and they came in together and they must go out together." Unquote. Samuel Clemens, also known as Mark Twain, as predicted, dies the very next year on April 21st in 1910, one day after Halley's Comet. And when he was born, he was actually born on November 30th of 1835, 2 weeks after Halley's Comet closest approach that year. His cause of death? Well, it was a heart attack. He came and he went with Halley, just as he predicted. Mark Twain was fascinated with the supernatural and paranormal. And when the Society for Physical Research was founded, you better freaking believe he was one of the very first members. and their society is still going strong to this very day. Throughout the years, I have talked about other premonitions and other episodes, such as Natalie Woods, when she was told by a psychic that she would die in water, in which she was absolutely petrified of. Or how about Lincoln, when he saw his own body lying in wake, and how he was told that the president had been shot, and he was indeed dead. Or that time when James Dean was warned not to drive Little Bastard or he would be dead by the end of the week, and that's exactly what happened. Or my favorite, because it has to do with me, the premonition my mother had. She went to go check on me when I was just like 14 months old. Then she went on to continue doing a paint class. When she had the most horrible feeling, insisting on checking on me again, this woman was sitting in front of her and her finger was missing. And it just shook my mom to the core. She knew something was wrong. She jumped up, she ran, she could hear me screaming bloody murder, only to see my finger hanging by a thread as it had been closed into a glass sliding door and it had to be sewn back on. Premonitions. Big shout out to country legend Bobby Mackey and Zachary Johnson and Andrew Kolb and their band Stick the Landing for providing me with the music for this episode. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others, my friends. They are phenomenal. Haven't heard every single one yet? There's really no need to worry. You can binge listen to your heart's fright and delight by hopping on to any of those podcast platforms, such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podcast Republic, basically wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers Podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everybody, and be sure to check out the annual 9/11 episode coming up in just a couple of days.